Please keep in mind, the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you.
Welcome to the Thin Men. I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
So today we're going to start out with the review of Foxcatcher, Steve Carell's Oscar-nominated performance.
And Bennett Miller's Oscar-nominated directing turn.
We're going to be talking about some films that you may not know about or performances, perhaps.
Not Oscar snubs so much as things you might have missed in the frenzy of the Oscar announcements.
Yeah, and also some snubs.
Some snubs.
So without further delay, let's begin the show. Someone is around. So today we're doing Foxcatcher, a film at the Myrna Loy right now.
That's right. And in theaters near you, most likely as well.
Steve Carell's been nominated for Best Supporting Actor?
Best Actor.
Best Actor, okay. Yep.
And Bennett Miller for Best Director. And the film had three other Academy Award nominations as well. However, a Best Picture nod was not among them.
It was a good year for Best Picture.
Yeah, it was.
It was a lot of, including a couple we reviewed on the show. So I think we got Theory of Everything up there.
We've got Whiplash up there.
Yeah, Birdman.
We got Birdman up there.
I think that's all three of them,
yeah,
right?
for the run of the show so far. Yeah.
There's probably a couple that we weren't running the show when they came to the Loy, I'm guessing.
But. Yep. And then some that just didn't come to the Loy.
So Foxcatcher is basically the true story of John DuPont. Basically, he was a very rich man from a very rich family from the DuPont.
Yeah, you may have heard the name DuPont before.
Yeah, they make everything rubber.
They're on Jeff Gordon's NASCAR jacket.
And they were actually, they got a lot of notice for the stuff that they did in wrestling.
Yes.
I believe in 88, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was John's passion project. He was a legacy to the money. And so he used his mostly for philanthropy, especially in amateur athletics. He was a big supporter of amateur athletics, none more so than wrestling, which he spent millions building his Foxcatcher wrestling compound and hiring the Schultz brothers to train there.
Yeah. And he was crazy. Let's just be honest. He was crazy. Is that fair to say?
I've heard so many conflicting reports on like his level of craziness that I don't want to be too decisive, just because this John DuPont as a man is fascinating to me, because I don't totally understand him, and I don't think we ever will, especially considering he's passed away now.
Well, you didn't know him well enough to call him Eagle.
Yeah, absolutely. But, and that's case in point, is even if he wasn't quote unquote crazy in any traditional or colloquial or medical sense, there's something very off about the man.
Yeah.
Like he has a very strange relationship with his mother. He has a very strange relationship with other adult men in his life. Like, he's someone who has a strange way of approaching interaction.
So this film essentially follows Dave Schultz and
Mark Schultz,
who were both Olympians, who won the gold medals.
Yep.
Yeah.
Legendary, like national championships in college. Like, they are both legendary among the amateur wrestling scene. We open following Channing Tatum, who plays Mark Schultz in the film. And he is the younger brother of Dave Schultz, and he's sort of portrayed as having lived in his shadow.
We start out, he basically lives to serve Dave in a way. He clearly wants to break out of the shadow, but he doesn't know how. And everything he does revolves around his brother. That's where DuPont steps in and basically gives him an opportunity to go and start training at his Foxcatcher facility with some other wrestlers.
Yeah.
It becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that DuPont is pretty off.
Yes.
Yeah. Steve So Steve Carell is playing him, and now this is it's not a wonder that he was up for an Oscar. I mean, it's not a performance where it's gonna like knock you on your ass, but when you step back and watch it, you really believe that this was an actual person, and you don't believe it's Steve Carell.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, they do some makeup to make him look.
Yeah, he has a prosthetic nose.
Yeah.
And he's got this very sallow skin.
And they use a prosthetic nose to kind of minimize Steve Carell's nose,
yes.
I think. You know what I mean? Like to make him look more like a blue blood kind of guy.
Absolutely.
But Steve Carell plays him so well.
It's so subtle and understated. And the thing that really stands out to me is this feels like a very lived-in performance. It feels like, you know, when you see Steve Carell as John DuPont on screen, you feel as though Steve Carell has always been John DuPont.
Yeah.
Like it feels like, it does not feel like someone taking on that identity so much as someone living that identity, which is what method actors are often going for, but so rarely able to achieve.
Yeah, and Steve Carell does such a great job in this. I mean, I know a lot of the time when a comedian steps in and does a great job, you're like, wow, but
this is
it's incredible. And part of it is because it is such a serious role.
But that's a good performance.
Couple of scenes, there's just a couple of scenes where there's like a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And because Steve Carell is such an accomplished comedic actor, he can really bring it out without like stepping outside of the character.
Yeah, without giving it away. And it's one of those performances that like, it's easy to view it as one of those. It's a very good dramatic performance for a comedian. But this is a very good performance for anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And it's not Steve Carell's first turn playing a dark character.
No.
He's played a couple before, but...
But this is by far the darkest, I would say.
The darkest, and I would also say, I mean, he's transformed by this
Absolutely.
Character. Whereas, like, in other movies, you look at it, and it's like, it's Steve Carell playing this character. And this movie, you know, this is John DuPont you're looking
at.
Yeah,
the
way
he breathes is not Steve Carell. The way he moves is not Steve Carell. The way he looks at people is not Steve Carell. Like, it is a full-on transformation.
And it's interesting because I feel like if you were to describe this to people, you know, if you say, well, it's this guy who's basically in charge of everything and, you know, he's a little bit off and everybody looks at him like he's crazy and he wants to be this thing that he can never be. Mm-hmm. And everybody mocks him for it secretly, but
they can't let it slide in
face.
Front of him. Yeah.
You would think that they were casting him for the boss in the office.
Absolutely.
When you just say it that way, and so you could see why they initially looked at him for the part, but it is not the same part. And mm-hmm. it's just amazing. I can't speak highly enough. About
I really feel it's the best work of his career.
Yeah.
I really feel that way. It's transcendent for him.
Now, Mark Ruffalo equally as captivating.
Agreed.
In his role.
He's magnetic. And everything in this movie, the sort of go word in my mind for this movie is subtlety. Like every moment is allowed to breathe and rest. Like all these characters, they're not flashy in the way Oscar roles are. Like Steve Carell's character is as flashy as it gets. And it's not a flashy role.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark Ruffalo, he's not asked to do anything that you would visibly recognize as like incredible acting. Like he has no,
he's clearly a serious minded wrestler who cares about his family. And that is his number one
Absolutely.
Priority in anything he does. It's always for his family.
And Mark Ruffalo is able to add this depth and shading to it that makes it feel three dimensional. Despite that, if you were to just look at the dialogue on the page, like that is a flat character. That is a one dimensional character in the script. Like all the things you learn about the character don't come from the character's mouth. They come from the people around him.
And so the interesting thing is his younger brother gets swept up in John DuPont initially
mm-hmm.
and just wants to please him. It's almost like his new father figure because clearly Dave Schultz is his father figure at the beginning.
Yeah, and he's now transferring this admiration to someone else.
Yes, and John DuPont leads him to some dark mm-hmm. corners, which I don't know how much we should explore in this review, but if you read the newspaper stories back in the day,
you know
what it's
basically
all about.
How this plays out. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing with this character, with Mark Ruffalo, is you see him at the beginning, he genuinely cares about his brother, and he wants to, like, he's trying to make him understand, like, I can't run off on this flight of fancy with you, mm-hmm. but this could be a good thing for you. Go ahead and do it, you know. But he's more about being stable for his family. And then so when he finally comes out to the Foxcatcher facility, there's this little subtle shift. But now it's also that he cares about his brother, but he's also trying to rein in John DuPont. He's mm-hmm. almost like trying to be like a fatherly figure to John DuPont, who really needs one, clearly. Yeah,
he needs someone to guide him.
Yeah, but he's so obsessed with being the father figure and guiding other people. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think about it until I started talking but about now this, but there's a lot of fathers in this movie.
And the way the relationships between the three main characters all parallel one another is just masterfully constructed.
And Mark Ruffalo does this really interesting thing physically where every time when you see him walking distances, which the Foxcatcher facility, basically his home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, he's got all these acres of land. And so there'll be scenes where you'll see Mark Ruffalo walking between things. And he does this thing where he's not exactly shimmying like a wrestler does, but his hands are kind of out as if he's in a wrestling ring all the time. And it's not done in a hokey way. It's more done like this guy lives and breathes wrestling. Yeah,
he's
so
been
much.
In this position so long that that's how his body is at rest.
Yeah, like he's honed his body to do this one thing. And so even when he's just relaxing, he's still got this almost wrestler pose. It's a really interesting choice that Absolutely. He made. What happens when you break it down is the younger brother gets sucked in. He starts to turn away from John DuPont as things get really wild, and he starts to just want out.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason that he genuinely wants out is because it becomes very clear that DuPont was using him to get his brother. All that along, he wanted his brother to come. Yeah. And once he gets his brother, John DuPont's okay with cutting the excessive.
The affection appendage. Is no longer there.
Yeah. And so that's when things start to really spin out of control. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing I think about this movie that I was really thinking about is how quiet it is.
And that fits right in with the subtlety thing. Is like there's a lot of sort of ambient space in the film.
Yeah, and it's so quiet, and it really eventually it brings you to that place where you're just so ensconced in it that when something happens at the very end, if you don't know the story, it happens so suddenly and so quickly. It is jarring, and it should be a jarring thing, but a lot of time in movies, it does like these big events don't necessarily jar you because you know what it is going into it. But the way that they're so quiet and subtle that when it finally happens, it is genuinely jarring. Like you're just like knocked off of your feet.
Considering you know it's coming the whole time.
Yeah.
And your body's waiting for it. And so it stops being a matter of if this event is going to happen, and it becomes a matter of when. And no matter how much you're looking for it, when the moment finally comes, it still pulls you out of your seat.
Yeah, it really does. And it's even the noise of the event at the end, just like I was when I went to watch this, I typically go to these movies on Tuesday nights. Mm-hmm. And, we don't always have like a big crowd on Tuesday nights at the theater, but there was quite a few people for what's normally there. And I happened to, in my peripheral, catch a lot of the people. Everybody jumped at the climax.
Yep.
Which is exactly what you want when the story is building to that. But everybody's going in knowing it's going
to
happen.
And that's the other thing is this film is constantly ratcheting up the tension to build to that moment without ever letting it release.
Yeah. But once again, there are a couple of funny scenes that are like organically
breathing
funny.
Moments.
There's a scene that I referred to earlier where John DuPont is talking to Mark, and he's saying like, you can call me John or Eagle or Golden Eagle. And you believe that he's saying that, but it's so funny when you hear it. It's so pathetic. And there's another scene that like has two purposes in the movie. So there's a scene where you see John DuPont wrestling.
Yes.
And they're all in there to support him. And on the one hand, it's there to show you how everybody is eating out of his hand, and they have to like feed him this fantasy to keep
It's the Emperor's
money train going.
It's the Emperor's new clothes moment. Yeah. Like, everyone can see that the Emperor is naked but him.
And so it's crucial to the movie that they have this scene and that they really set it up to show you the extent that all these characters, and not just Mark and Dave, but everybody else mm-hmm. around them. There's all these other wrestlers too
that yeah, these that people sort of spinning around in the orbit of that main trifecta.
And it's important to show how much they're trying to help him in this moment and like feed his delusion. But at the same time, it's absolutely hilarious yes. to see this clueless erudite like wrestling this other person, basically cheating in the yeah. process and being like paid off to win.
Yeah.
It's hilarious at the same time.
And there's a bit
it releases tension while it also builds it because you know what it's building to.
Yes.
It's pretty brilliant the way that they construct it.
There's also that moment where Mark, the Channing Tatum character, starts binge eating. And it's this very dark, sort of twisted moment within the story, but it has this amazing sort of physical comedy to it, like this very dark black comedy, but it's all sort of like a sociopath's version of a pratfall, this scene.
See, and what was interesting was I feel like it ratcheted up the tension with me. Mm-hmm. This is two movies in a row where I actually have some personal experience with it. Because in this, I did wrestle for a couple years in school. And like, weight is
everything
in wrestling. If you can't get to the weight you're supposed to be or under, you're disqualified. Like, you don't even get a chance to
and
face
everyone,
the person. You have a deadline that's like, it's this minute you have to be at this weight. And if you're not at that weight at that minute, you're not wrestling.
And every coach wants their wrestlers wrestling like one late weight class lower than they should be. Like, it's a constant push to get to this ideal weight.
Yeah, and that's why you would see it like, not just in wrestling, but in boxing has the same sort of thing. And that's mm-hmm. that's why you'll see in like, say, a Rocky movie or something where somebody's running in a heavy sweatshirt and stuff like that before the weigh-in. Like,
yeah, they trying have to get all the water out of their body.
Yep. You have to bring in that weight, which is kind of a messed up thing. Wrestling's a little messed up.
Especially for high school and middle school kids. It's really destructive to the bodies.
Yeah, which is when I did like seventh grade.
Most people do it. Yeah, is middle school and high school. And it's so destructive to your body, especially that early on where your body is constantly developing and needs that hydration.
Yeah, I had to lose 3 pounds before a meet. Like, I weighed in the morning and I was 3 pounds heavy. And so I ran around a track with a plastic suit 10 times, like a quarter mm-hmm. mile track, and went and still didn't make the weight. And then I had to go and run on pedal on an exercise bike. And I finally just barely made the weight so that I could get on the bus to go to, some rinky dink little town to wrestle a guy who didn't even show up.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the thing with wrestling too, is not only you're not only wrestling for your individual points, but it's also for the team. Like, every point that you get goes towards your team's points. And so you can see how these wrestlers would pull together in the movie mm-hmm. and help each other out. And, you know, there's no room for jealousy in wrestling. There's
absolutely
just
not
because everybody's crucial.
Yeah, you cannot be competing with the people who are on your side. You just cannot do it.
Yeah. And so that really feeds into his relationship with his brother because he's always on the same teams that he is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're on the same teams, like, you can be like, I want to get out of my brother's shadow, but you also need to be working in concert with him at the same time. And that makes it a really interesting dynamic because then when you bring in John DuPont, they have to work with him, but they're also pushing back at the crazy a little
bit.
And they push back in different ways, you know,
absolutely.
As we said, the eating with
Mark Schultz.
Yeah. I mean, that was just destructive and mm-hmm. not helpful, but you look at the pushback with Dave and it's all just trying to get John DuPont to see the light very subtly and very fatherly, which leads to the climax of the movie. So I really recommend seeing this, like, just, but be prepared to watch like a quiet, understated movie.
And it's bleak as well.
Yeah.
Like it's bleak.
As most movies up for an Oscar this year
tend to be.
Bleak.
Yeah. It's a very bleak one. So go in knowing that this is not a happy story, but it's a story worth seeing. Thank you.
What you want me to bring you back? I'm going away. What you want me to bring you back? Think about the dying world, mama, that I surely lack.
Okay, so now we're doing our picks for movies that were maybe overlooked at the Oscars or performances that were overlooked.
Yeah, things you might have missed. Not snubs in like that sort of aggressive sense of like, oh, how could you miss this? But things that might have slid under some radars.
Although I might get upset when we're talking. I want to talk about Bill Murray and St. Vincent. This movie is great. This is a little independent movie that a guy named Theodore Melfi came up with. Essentially, this follows a character who is despicable.
Yeah.
This is a lower than dirt character who is brilliantly played by Bill Murray and actually had some Oscar buzz. I think the problem here with the Oscars was that he wasn't really willing to play the game.
And when you couple that with a really strong best actor field...
Yeah.
Like, if you're not willing to play at all, like, there's just nothing you're going to see when there's, I mean, there's probably 15 worthy candidates in that field. So you have to be willing to play ball to some degree.
Yeah. But essentially, this character, he has a gambling problem. He really has a people problem.
Yeah. He has an interaction problem.
His idea of a good time is basically to hire a Russian prostitute to come by, who's a stripper in her spare time, played brilliantly by Naomi Watts, by the way. Like, you would not know it's Naomi
Watts. Good year for Naomi Watts.
Yeah. Yeah, she really did a great job this year. She's stretching her wings for sure. So he's this despicable character. We see him at the beginning. He winds up going on a bender. After he gets kicked out of his favorite local bar, he knocks down his own fence. And then after he knocks down his own fence, like, passes out in his place. Melissa McCarthy plays a very understated character, not playing the humor at all. Like, she's very much the straight man in this movie. And she moves in with the son. And some movers knock down part of a branch of a tree, to which he not only mentions how they knocked over the branch of the tree and ruined his tree, but also knocked down his fence, which clearly he still has a tire on part of the fence. So it's very clear that he knocked over the fence, but he is maintaining throughout the entire movie that they messed up the fence and that they need to pay for it. And so basically this movie is, he winds up babysitting the kid that Melissa McCarthy has, and she's going through a divorce. And the really interesting thing about this is there's a lot of characters in this movie. There's no real bad guys in this movie. There just isn't. Like, when you look through it, the kid is just trying to understand the world, basically. His mother, at first you think, is like, oh, well, she's just trying to raise this kid, and her husband had cheated on her and it was this horrible thing. But you start to learn, like, she can't help but rip down the husband in front of the kid. And at the same time, you realize that there was some deficits on her end of the marriage as well. They adopted this kid and just, they could never really make the family fit right. And so when they separated, it was a problem. And actually, her ex-husband, it was played by a guy who's in 30 Rock. And he was also a Mr. Show before that. Scott Adsit.
Oh, Scott Adsit.
Who also plays really well for the little bit of screen time that he has. St. Vincent... or just Vincent, actually. Kind of takes the kid under his wing. In doing so, also winds up taking the kid to the track. There's a scene where he decides he wants the kid to call his mother to make sure she knows that he's all right.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, well, I don't have any money. He goes, well, here. And, like, hands him a quarter. And the kid goes, it costs more than that for a payphone. He's like, since when? And he's like, since the 90s. And so he takes out an ashtray and just dumps it on the kid's lap. And it's got some change, but mostly ashes and butts. So the kid goes to call on the payphone, and then some bullies come up to pick on him. And of course, Vincent comes out and sees what's going on and feels guilty because he's seeing a stripper the whole time that the kid's out here. And he sticks up for him. He breaks the bully's board in half. Now, you could make this bully a one-dimensional, you know, kid, and just, like, he's out there to make a rough time for the kid. They wind up being friends by the end. They get punished at the same time for something that's going on in school. They spend some time together, and they realize that, you know, they're kind of alike. every single character in here has their low moments and they have their high moments. Vincent more than anybody. Because while we see all this scuzzy stuff that Bill Murray's character does, at the same time, he's going and he's visiting his wife who has Alzheimer's and can't even remember who he is. Freaks out when he tries to like peck her on the cheek, or like the only way he can even visit her is by pretending like he's a doctor or like he's doing her laundry, like he's some kind of a worker for her. Mm-hmm. So that's how he gets in with his wife. So you realize he does all these things, but he's got a soft underbelly for sure. And Bill Murray just plays it so well. I mean, he's so likable despite being so despicable. And the kid realizes it, you know, pretty fast out of the gate, and you could see why the kid realizes it. You know, there's these little subtle things that he does. At a certain point in the movie, he winds up having a stroke, and he plays the stroke brilliantly. I'm a caregiver by trade, and when you see him in the hospital recovering from the stroke, it genuinely sounds like somebody who had a stroke. Like, clearly Bill Murray either knew somebody who had a stroke or spent some time learning what that was like. But Bill Murray really did a great job, and I would just think it would be a shame without him being recognized. So since it can't be from the Oscars, it'll be by the Thin Man.
That's right. We hand out our own recognition.
But definitely see St. Vincent. It's a really fun movie.
One performance I want to talk about is it's from the film Nightcrawler, and I've talked about it here and on Skies.
I was going to bring that up as well.
Are you bringing up the same person as me?
Maybe. Go ahead.
So a lot of lip service has been paid to Jake Gyllenhaal.
That was who I was going to bring up.
Oh, that's not who I'm bringing up.
Okay.
I'm going deeper. And it's well-deserved lip service. He's incredible. A lot of people bring up Rene Russo. Well-deserved lip service. It's incredible. A lot of people bring up Bill Paxton for his small role. The guy who gets lost in the shuffle is Riz Ahmed.
Oh, yes.
Who
yes,
plays
his partner.
Yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal's partner. And he's incredible. He's been in things before. He's a rapper and actor. He's British. And he's been in some things I've seen that I don't remember him in. And he's been prominent in a lot of things I haven't seen but want to check out now. He's fantastic. He's got this nervous energy that feels very realistic, but also sort of becomes a pervading sense of all his scenes. Like, it adds to this sort of jittery, hyper aggressive builds in the film that he's involved with. He's always involved with Jake Gyllenhaal's more shady dealings in the film. And he plays it so well. You know, he comes in looking bewildered, and you can tell he's sort of a dim character and he doesn't really understand what's going on. But as the film goes on, you see him progress into someone who's starting to pick up on what the Jake Gyllenhaal character has been from the first moment of the film. And so you see this arc he goes through, you see this energy he brings to the role. And it's sort of sad that he got lost in the shuffle of that movie specifically, and also the supporting actor talk in general. Because, I mean, he comes out of nowhere and he feels so real to this world, so true to this movie. It'd be really easy for that character to come off as a character from a different film, like this weird, idiosyncratic, jittery, anxious guy, could very easily be played in a very slapsticky, broad comedy way. But Riz Ahmed is able to bring this grounding aspect to it that makes it fit right into the world.
Yeah, he's the conscience that Jake Gyllenhaal's character lacks.
Absolutely.
He's able to play the comedy in that,
he's
too.
Really funny.
Because
he's really
this,
funny.
There's this absolutely hilarious scene where he demands a raise. And he's demanding a raise the whole time, but finally he's going to get
the
raise.
He's putting his foot down this time.
Yeah, and so Jake
Gyllenhaal.
And
he finally has leverage. For the first time in the movie, he has leverage when he's asking for it.
Yes, and so he asks him how much he wants. Do you remember the total?
Oh, I can't even. He starts.
Because he's making, he's making
like
$30
a night, basically.
Yeah.
And they're out all night. And he's, I can't even remember. I know he goes to a
it's
number.
It's something like was it $50?
Well, no,
like
he starts at like, I want $100. And then he negotiates.
And he goes, no, he goes, done. And then he goes.
And he negotiates himself down.
Well, I thought he goes for $100 and then Jake Gyllenhaal goes, done.
No, because remember he goes.
And then he goes. So just out of curiosity, if I'd asked for more, would I have got more? And he goes, definitely.
No, you missed a step in that conversation, which he starts going, 100, no, 50. And he goes, done. And he goes, you would have given me the 100, wouldn't you? And he's like, yeah. He's
that's
would
right.
You have given me more? And he goes, absolutely. Yeah. Like, so he negotiates himself down.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And then he found out he could have gotten even more than what he started at.
It's so great.
It's brilliantly played. really I need to see more of this guy's work. He's been nominated for 3 British Independent Film Awards for Best Actor, so I need to go find those movies apparently.
Yeah, and he actually serves a very important role in the movie too. Like, not only grounding everything, but at the very end, he serves a very crucial... In terms
of the plot, he's a very key cog in the machine of the ending.
Yeah, and to really see what Jake Gyllenhaal's character is
capable of,
you have to have this other character.
It's so fantastic. It's so well drawn. I mean, I love that movie. That's one of my favorite movies of the year. And when I realized even I didn't give Riz Ahmed the props he deserved, I had to fix that mistake.
Okay, another movie I want to bring up is Selma. Now, this was nominated for Best Picture. It was nominated for Best Song and not much else. I've got to say, David Oyelowo.
Oyelowo. We'll get there. It took me a lot of practice to get to this point. I screwed up his name approximately a billion times before I finally
David
got it down.
David is amazing as Martin Luther King. He is amazing in this movie. He's able to bring this wry little sense of humor that you wouldn't suspect that Martin Luther King would have, and yet ground it in this droll reality. The way that he can act off of all these other characters that are just devastated throughout the movie. Just the gravitas he holds when he's dealing with these really messed up situations within this protest. It's amazing. It's such a big load to put on an actor's shoulder. And the fact that he wasn't recognized, I do think he was robbed on this one.
That is a big snub. Yeah. Like, yeah. You can't find...
It's a great Best Actor pool.
Absolutely. It's a super strong year. He needs to be there.
Yeah. I won't, but I could name 2 people who didn't deserve it as much as he did. But I won't. That's another performance that should definitely be mentioned in the Oscars is Carmen Ejogo. I could be saying that wrong, but she played Coretta Scott King, his wife. She is amazing in this movie. It's got to be hard to not only play this real crucial character in history, but somebody who's still alive.
Yeah, someone who can see how you portray them.
Yeah, and she absolutely does it so well. There's a certain point in this movie where Coretta Scott King's character is basically, she's the driving force behind the plot and a certain point in the movie, and you cannot do this movie without that character. And she absolutely does it. She's got this way of like being hard as nails and doing what she needs, but showing this vulnerability. I mean, there's a whole storyline in this movie about how the FBI is trying to make her think that Martin Luther King Jr. is having an affair on her, and she has to like be strong enough to not believe it. And yet you can tell there's a part of her that really does doubt him. And it's really difficult for him. And just to be able to show the conflict that character goes through in the moments that they had. That's another character that should have been mentioned for the best supporting actress. And I'll just name one off the top of my head. Keira Knightley? No, dude. Strike her off. Put her in there because she absolutely deserved to get a nod for this movie. I also think, continuing on this movie, that the director should have been mentioned.
Ava DuVernay.
Yeah. This movie is incredible. Moved me to tears like 4 times.
This is something I really want to jump on, which is to say the Academy nominates Bennett Miller for Foxcatcher. It is a well-directed film. It's a well-deserved nomination. But Foxcatcher's not nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Now, Bennett Miller's not going to win. Like, we can pretty safely say Bennett Miller will not win. So why not give that spot to Ava DuVernay? We've never nominated a black woman for Best Director. She's, on all fronts, she's being acclaimed by the overwhelming majority of critics. And her film is a Best Picture. So my question to the Academy would be, what did she do wrong to not get this?
I mean, and the movie is incredible. Every performance, she gets every ounce of what she needs from every actor and actress in this movie. There's so many bit parts that just do so great. The whole thing centers around this bridge that they have to cross, which is almost like a metaphor for, you know,
almost
the bridge is a metaphor for this blockade that they have to get through to get what they need. And to be able to condense it to that idea in this biopic. It's just really well done. The way that they do the music, it just flows throughout the movie. It's nothing ever stands out, but it always builds on the movie and makes it better. Just the lighting is so well, the cinematography, just everything about this movie is so well done. I don't see why they didn't give her a nod, you know? So I guess that's my last complaint with the Oscars is you should have nominated this woman.
The next one I want to talk about is a film that was sort of widely ignored. And it's a little movie called Love is Strange, directed by Ira Sachs. And the film centers around these two, this older gay couple in New York City who've been together forever and are finally getting married. And the gay couple is played by John Lithgow and Alfred Molina. And they finally get married and they're sort of in their post-marital bliss and they lose their apartment. And so for a lot of the movie, they're forced to be apart from one another. And this movie, it's beautiful. Like, it's sort of meditations on love and what it does to us as people and how it brings us together and how it serves to drive wedge. Like, it goes in, like, it dives in from the high board into this, and it lives in that theme of what romantic love means for these people. And the performances are incredible. Alfred Molina plays the younger one of the couple, and he's sort of, his character is sort of bouncing around between this earnestness and this regret for the way his life has gone. And John Lithgow plays the slightly more comedic, sort of schlubby, pathetic one who's sort of comfortable in his ways. And you see the things that don't work between them, you see the things that do, but more than all, you can see why these two people love each other so much and how being separated while giving them bits of freedom and independence back also sort of tears apart what they've become. I mean, it's just a very gorgeous, quiet, meditative film. It's beautiful and more people should see it.
All right. So go see these movies.
Go see these movies. Thank you so much for joining us on another episode of The Thin Men. Look for us 2 weeks from today. Please come see Foxcatcher here at the Myrna Loy Center. You will not regret it, or at a theater near you. For those of you who would like to be kept in the loop on some of the live happenings around the Myrna, Montana Repertory Theater is kicking off their tour of The Great Gatsby. They're the theater group out of Missoula that works with the university. If you are listening to this as it comes out, they will be at the Myrna tonight at 7:30. Also this week on Friday at 7:30 and Saturday at 2, that's Friday, January 30th and Saturday, January 31st, we have Sandglass Theater's Degeneration and Exaltation of Larks, which is this incredible puppet performance that explores dementia and Alzheimer's and its effect on old people and how they view the world and their relationships. It's incredibly touching material, and I would love to see a lot of people here out for it. First week of February, our big show is Jamie Stone's The Lomax Project. It's celebrating the work of a folklorist named Alan Lomax. He's a field recording pioneer, and it brings together these distinctive sort of Americana roots musicians into sort of like a folksy super group to write these songs and perform these songs that celebrate this work of Alan Lomax. And that's on February 6th.
We will not be putting out an episode next week, but in 2 weeks we'll have another one, so stay listening.
Hey man, thanks for coming out to meet me. I've just been so down lately.
No problem, man. What's the matter?
It's so hard to talk about. my batting average isn't quite what it used to be.
Your batting average?
My drive shaft doesn't have the kind of torque I'm looking for, if you catch my drift.
So you're feeling some depression from your erectile dysfunction?
Some. I'm only feeling depression from my erectile dysfunction.
You know, it's something that helps me is the Not Safe for Network.
The Not Safe for Network? What's that?
Not Safe for Network.
Side effects include rule cards. That's available. We have a good life. Montauk Disguise. Box Office Battle. Within Men. And shooting the show. Do not take Not Safe for Network if you're on Cialis, Viagra, On Legend, or Comedy Central commercials at 4 a.m.
Not Safe for Network.
Wow. My whole world is new. Thanks, Not Safe for Network.
Not Safe for Network. Putting the function back in erectile dysfunction.
Not Safe for Network.